Today is May 18, 2020, and this is episode number 8 of Blurred Laws and Life. With me, your host, Richard Bush. Last week on the show, we had David Hill, who literally created Fox Sports. It was an incredible interview. It was inspiring. All the things he did, all the things he has done in his career really was impressive, to say the least. And during the course of the podcast, he mentioned that the greatest sports theme in his mind ever created was created by Scott Schrier, who created Fox NFL Sunday Show's theme. And Scott has also created, from what I understand now, many other incredible themes for many other Fox sports shows. And I wanted to have Scott as the perfect bookend to David Hill on today's podcast. But unfortunately, our schedules did not connect this week. There were some conflicts in getting that done, but Scott and I have spoken, and Scott has agreed to be on the podcast next week and make some time to do so. And believe me, it will be worth it. The music he has created is legendary and iconic. He is an incredible composer. He has done so many other things besides composing very well-known music for commercials and television shows that I'm really looking forward to next week. So without Scott this week, I was left debating what to do for today's podcast. And of course, I've mentioned over the last couple of weeks a very important constitutional issue that I am presently litigating on behalf of Eminem's music publisher in a lawsuit alleging copyright infringement against Spotify that implicates what is known as the Music Modernization Act. That is a very interesting academic question. And I mentioned the Tesla constitutional challenge that has some overlapping issues against the county of Alameda for not allowing them to begin production at the Fremont plant. But since I mentioned that, that particular case, the Tesla case, has been resolved. Tesla dropped that lawsuit because the county of Alameda backed down, and Tesla and its Fremont plant are back in operation. So that would have been an interesting case to discuss and compare it to the Music Modernization Act, but it's kind of an academic discussion, and we are all about having fun on Blurred Laws in Life. We are all about discussing legal cases that in which I can provide some anecdotes and some funny stories, and which epitomizes blurred laws. And I didn't have to think hard because I was involved in a case. I litigated a case against Sean Diddy Combs on behalf of my clients and against Bad Boy Records for copyright infringement that resulted in a jury verdict award for willful copyright infringement and an award of punitive damages by the jury that was originally north of $4 million. And it is virtually impossible to get a punitive damage award in a copyright infringement case, but I did. And also, you might remember that if you're listening to my podcast, and I hope you are, that a week or so ago, I mentioned an opponent of mine and a dear friend, Bob Sullivan, who I said passed away from leukemia several years ago, but who on one particular occasion epitomized character and honesty in a way that you don't find in this legal profession. And that was, that particular event was part of the case against Bad Boy Records for copyright infringement. And so I thought to myself, this is the perfect time to discuss all of that on Blurred Laws and Life. So I think the best place to start is to talk about Bob and to tell you Bob's story as it relates to the Bad Boy Records copyright infringement case. As I've mentioned multiple times on my podcast, on May 4th, 2001, I launched a massive lawsuit basically against the entire rap music industry, 480 cases alleging copyright infringement. Many of those cases were filed against a music publishing company known as EMI Music Publishing. They had, I don't know, maybe 50 of those cases. Cases were relatively spread out among all the major record labels and music publishers. EMI maybe had about 50 or so. And there were about five or six that involved Bad Boy Records, which was and is Sean Diddy Combs' record label, and that involved his publishing company that is known as Justin Combs Publishing. And Justin Combs Publishing is administered by EMI. I tell you this because Bob Sullivan represented EMI in that litigation. After a couple of years, maybe in 2003 or so, we began settlement negotiations with EMI, and of course, Bob was representing EMI in those settlement negotiations, and we ultimately reached a global settlement with EMI on all their different cases in that litigation. And because EMI administered Justin Combs Publishing, Diddy's publishing company, and we were not settling with Bad Boy Records, Diddy's record label, or Justin Combs Publishing, I made it clear to Bob that the EMI settlement agreement, although it released parties that EMI administered for, did not release Justin Combs Publishing or Bad Boy Records, or entities that were associated with Bad Boy Records and Justin Combs Publishing and were also defendants in the case. And we attempted to carve out those entities from the settlement agreement. So after we entered into the settlement agreement, the Sean Combs parties and the parties associated with the Bad Boy parties who were defendants claimed, despite the language carving them out, that they were released by the EMI settlement agreement. And you can imagine the pressure that Bob would have been under to support that view. One of the Bad Boy cases involving the Notorious B.I.G. song Ready to Die actually went to trial. And at the trial, the issue of whether the EMI settlement agreement released the parties to that lawsuit was at play. And of course, when Justin Combs Publishing Diddy side took the position that they were released, I called Bob and I said, you know, Bob, what the intention of our agreement was. You know what this language was meant to do. It's clear to me. It should be clear to you. We drafted it. And I need you to support the fact that these parties were not released. And like I said, you can imagine the pressure Bob must have been under from his own client. And to Bob's credit, when I called him, he said, you're right, Richard. We absolutely discussed this. It was the intention of this language to not release them by virtue of the EMI agreement. And I told him that Bob, you're going to do the right thing here, right? You're going to be honest about this. And he said, of course he was. And that case actually went to trial, as I mentioned. And that issue, as I said, was at play. And I actually had to call Bob as a witness at trial. And he, of course, stood up for the fact that we discussed this and that there was no intention to release the Sean Combs parties from the litigation. And I'll, of course, be discussing that entire case in a moment. But ultimately, there was a finding that there was no release of any of the parties to the litigation by virtue of the EMI settlement agreement. It should not be a big deal that someone stands up and tells the truth. It should be something that is natural. It should be something that is not necessarily to be overly praised, because we expect people to tell the truth. But, you know, in this profession and in the real world, there's a lot of pressure that comes to bear on people. And the fact that Bob stood up and did that is something that I will never forget. As I mentioned, he died of leukemia several years after that. But he is he was a very honorable man. And I just felt compelled to tell his story. Of all the cases that I have taken to trial, and that includes Blurred Lines, and that includes the Eminem digital download case, the case of Westbound Records versus Bad Boy Records and Justin Combs Publishing was by far the most fun. And there are so many stories to tell about it that I guess I've waited a long time to be able to tell them, because this is the perfect place for it. It epitomizes, the case epitomizes Blurred Laws and life. And I am happy to have the opportunity to share those stories with all of you. Under the United States Copyright Act, sound recordings, as opposed to musical compositions, were first protected by federal copyright law, beginning with recordings first fixed on a master as of February 15th, 1972. I bet you didn't know that. You want to know why I know that? I know that because in the Westbound Records versus Bad Boy Records case, my clients brought a claim for copyright infringement based upon the alleged copying of both their musical composition and sound recording by the Ohio Players, entitled Singing in the Morning, on a Bad Boy Records release, Notorious B.I.G.'s Ready to Die. We brought a claim under the Federal United States Copyright Act for copyright infringement of both the musical composition and sound recording. And we alleged that a part of Singing in the Morning was looped throughout Ready to Die. We were litigating the case based upon the notion that the claims were covered by the U.S. Copyright Act. One day, I was minding my own business, perhaps even having lunch, when I received a letter from my opponent in the case. Very serious letter, I believe it was hand-delivered. And in it, they said, "We've been doing research on the alleged infringed song, Singing in the Morning, and we have discovered news articles or some type of information that shows that the recording of Singing in the Morning was actually first fixed on the master, first released. The Singing in the Morning album was actually first released maybe February 5th, 1972, or end of January of 1972. But not February 15th of 1972 or after. And therefore, because, as you know, Mr. Bush, federal copyright law only protects and governs sound recordings first fixed on a master after February 15th of 1972, you do not have a claim for copyright infringement, federal copyright infringement, under the U.S. Copyright Act against the defendants. And we demand that you immediately dismiss your claim for copyright infringement of the sound recording of Singing in the Morning, because there's no protection for it. And if you do not do so, I believe the letter said, we will pursue what are called Rule 11 sanctions for bringing a frivolous lawsuit against our clients. Quite a shock. I had thought that Singing in the Morning, based on our information, was released later in the spring of 1972, and that we had federal copyright protection over it, and that our claim on the sound recording, now that remember, this does not implicate the musical composition, but that our claim for the sound recording was validly brought under the U.S. Copyright Act. So, aha, they got me. In fact, as I looked at it, it appeared that, yes, the sound recording for Singing in the Morning was released right before February 15th of 1972. So, yes, it looked like I did not have a claim under the United States Copyright Act for infringement of Singing in the Morning.
But upon further review, as they say during football games when they go to the instant replay, guess what I did have? Just because I didn't have a claim for federal copyright infringement, I did have a claim for various state law causes of action. Because without the Federal Copyright Act protecting sound recordings first fixed on a master before February 15th, 1972, you can bring claims for state law conversion, state law unfair competition, common law copyright infringement.
And here's the kicker. What I also discovered is that while one cannot get punitive damages under the United States Copyright Act, one can get punitive damages under state law for claims for unfair competition or common law copyright infringement, meaning copyright infringement brought under state law. But you can only bring those claims for sound recordings that were not first fixed on a master after 1972. So what do? We said, okay, you got me. We'll dismiss our federal copyright law claims on the sound recording, but we're going to amend our complaint and we're going to bring a bunch of claims under state law. And while we didn't have punitive damage claim before, guess what? We do now. And we amended our complaint and we brought claims under state law for the infringement of Singing in the Morning, and we added claims for punitive damages. So one other really interesting issue in the Bad Boy case was damages. Under copyright law, you can get your actual damages, which would be, you know, what you might have licensed the song for had you licensed it, the percentage of the song you would have asked for, and the percentage of the royalties you might have asked to receive had you licensed it, had it been licensed properly. But in addition, you can get the profits of the defendant that they obtained. They have to disgorge their profits attributable to the infringement. And the way it works is that all of the defendant's revenue, gross revenue, is deemed attributable to the infringement unless they set forth evidence to show that there are other factors that drove that revenue separate and apart from the use of the infringing material. So they have the burden of producing cost information, and they have the burden of showing that other factors drove sales of the record besides the infringing material. And one more important setup for my discussion of the case that I want to tell you is that in the usual federal court case, both sides get an opportunity to depose, which means question, the other side's experts before trial. So the way it works is, in a federal court case, the experts retained by each side have to submit full written reports that contain all of the opinions they are planning to offer at trial. And before trial, the other side gets to conduct a deposition of the expert to kind of figure out what they're going to say and to cross-examine them and to see if there are holes that can be poked in their reports. But in the litigation that we filed in Nashville, the 480 cases, They were originally before this older judge, Judge Higgins, who was really old school. And he had a rule that there would be no depositions of experts in any of the cases. And his theory was that experts are being paid, that they are submitting a full report with all their opinions. You know what they're going to say, and you should just be able to come to trial and cross-examine them and do your best there, and that it is a waste of time and money to actually conduct depositions of experts before trial, and that the only one who makes money off of that is the lawyers, and it costs the parties money. And he did not believe in expert depositions, so we did not have any, believe it or not. That is probably unheard of to any lawyers or law school students who are listening to this podcast, but it's an absolute fact. We did not have expert depositions, so we had to actually just come to trial and do our best at cross-examining the experts at the trial, do whatever damage we could do. But there were no depositions, and the first time that you heard the actual testimony of the expert was at trial. You did not get a sneak preview during a deposition. Now, as far as the facts are concerned, as mentioned, my clients own the rights to the Ohio Players song and sound recording, Singing in the Morning, and the Bad Boy Records release that was at issue was, as I mentioned, the Notorious B.I.G. title track, Ready to Die. And the title track was produced by a producer by the name of Austin Harvey Jr. Now, while we couldn't conduct depositions of experts, we, of course, could conduct depositions of fact witnesses. And we tried to find Austin Harvey Jr., but by the time we went to trial, it was 2004 or so, and I think the Ready to Die album came out in 1995 or 1996 or 1997. Not sure exactly now, but it had been a while. And we could not at first locate Austin Harvey Jr. One of the first depositions we took was of Sean Combs himself.
And this deposition testimony was played in open court at trial. And also, I examined Mr. Combs live at trial, and he repeated the same thing.
And I played for Mr. Combs the actual music from Singing that we allege was copied. And then we played the music from Ready to Die that we said was included without permission, and it is identical. There was no question it was sampled. It was so obvious. It was the same music. And I played it both for Mr. Combs, and I asked him if the two pieces of music sounded alike, and his response was he wasn't qualified to answer that question. That's what he said in open court. And I said, what do you mean? You know, you are a record producer, you own a record label, what do you mean? And he said he was not the producer, so he couldn't say whether it was sampled or not. And I again asked, well, I'm not saying, is it a sample? What I'm asking you is, does it sound the same? And again, he said that he wasn't qualified to answer that question, and that was his testimony. And ultimately, we found Austin Harvey Jr., and we conducted a deposition of him. And lo and behold, what did Austin Harvey Jr. say? Austin Harvey Jr. testified that originally they wanted to use, or he wanted to use, a Jimi Hendrix track for Ready to Die, but they could not get clearance from the Jimi Hendrix estate. And so he went and used Ohio Players' Singing in the Morning. And I asked him, did Mr. Combs know about the use of Singing in the Morning? And he testified that yes, it had to be approved by him. So yeah, that's what happened. And we presented that evidence to the jury during the course of the trial. On the damages front, and this is really interesting, for whatever reason, Bad Boy in that case did not produce any evidence of their actual costs that they incurred in creating Ready to Die. Did not produce the actual evidence of their costs. It is very important for you to understand, for everyone to understand, that in a copyright infringement case, the only obligation of the plaintiff is to put up on the board the gross revenue of the defendant. That's it. The gross revenue of the defendant. The defendant then has the burden of whittling that down and showing other factors attributable to that gross revenue that led to their profit, or if they can't, all of the gross revenue is deemed to be profit. Very important that you understand that, because in this case, as I will soon tell you, we ended up receiving an award of 100% of the gross revenue of Bad Boy with respect to Ready to Die, the song, with no deductions. In addition to that, they claimed that the use of the Singing in the Morning track was inconsequential. That, and I remember this from the opening statement, he said something along the lines of the fact that, you know, the Ready to Die song is a beautiful car with a beautiful engine, and that the Singing in the Morning music that was included was nothing more than a dirty hubcap or a small hubcap on a very expensive, beautiful car. So that the use was inconsequential and that we should not receive any of the profits because of that. Now let me tell you the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say. And what I think might be one of the best moments of my career and probably the best cross-examination that I ever did at trial. So as I mentioned earlier, the judge's rules prevented depositions of experts before trial. And the defense in the case hired an expert. And remember, I told you that they didn't produce any cost information. So the defense in the case called an expert that is a very experienced auditor in the music business. And he came in, and I would say their direct examination of their economic expert lasted 2 or 3 hours. And what he did was they came in with a PowerPoint for the jury and went through all of the usual and ordinary costs that a record label would incur in creating an album and a record like Ready to Die. And he had at the top line the revenue that was received, and then he would subtract all of these usual and ordinary costs from the revenue to get to the point where they argued there was zero profit to be disgorged and that we should get zero in damages. So that lasted, I believe, the entire morning of one of the days of trial. And I remember sitting during lunch across the street in Nashville, across from the federal court, there's a museum. It's called the Frist Museum now, I believe. And we were having lunch there, and we were talking about how to attack his direct examination. And I decide, and we had done some research on him, and we knew that he was an experienced auditor and that he usually represented artists in auditing record labels, and that he actually was proponent of legislation that would, I believe, make record labels liable for punitive damages if they don't pay artists royalties correctly. There was some proposed legislation in California that he was behind in that regard. And my associates were, you know, feeding me questions and about attacking his methodology. And I said to them, I said, we cannot attack his methodology. There's no way that I can go tit for tat with someone so experienced, a CPA, on these financial numbers. And I remember scratching out 6 or 7 questions over lunch, believe it or not, and deciding just then how to approach my cross-examination of him. And we went back in, and remember, he had done, I'd say, 3 good hours of direct examination. And I don't know, it was 5 questions, may have been 10, but I essentially cross-examined him by saying just the following. I said something along the lines of, you usually represent artists, do you not? Yes. And you audit record labels all the time? Yes. And isn't it true that record labels are notorious for underpaying artists? They're well known for that. Isn't that true? And he said, yes. When you do audits, you usually find that your clients are owed money, right? Yes. And in fact, you're behind legislation that would really increase penalties on record labels in the event that they underpay artists, aren't you? And he said, yes. And I said, let me ask you a question with all that said. If you went into a record label to do an audit and they said to you, I'm sorry, sir, we just can't seem to find our cost information. We can't find any of the backup for the costs that we charged your artist. But just take our word for it. These are the ordinary and usual costs that we would incur, and you should accept that those were the costs that we incurred in your case. I said, as an auditor, would you accept that? And after a little hemming and hawing, he said, no. And I said, but isn't that exactly what you're asking the jury to do here, to accept what you would never accept in the ordinary course of your auditing of record labels? You're asking them to take their word for it when they haven't produced any information of costs. You're asking this jury to do what you would not do in the ordinary course of your business. Isn't that right? And he had to say yes. And I said, no further questions.
And we received 100% of the gross revenue of the defendants with no deductions. In other words, all of the revenue was deemed attributable to the infringement.
To this day, that is, in my mind, one of the best moments I've had in a courtroom.
With respect to the other way that my opponent tried to claim that 100% of the gross revenue should not be awarded to the plaintiffs, to us.
Which was to claim that the music used was insignificant. We obviously put on expert witnesses to talk about how important it was, that it ran throughout the entire song, that it was the only music, I believe, that was actually in the song, that it played over, you know, the lyrics and all of that. But what was really fun was in my closing argument, I ended up putting together a video montage, and the video montage included deposition testimony that was offered by many of the witnesses on the other side that we and then contradicted by conflicting evidence that we believe showed that, you know, we didn't believe what they were saying was true. And then it ended up with we put together this kind of a cartoon at the end of playing the deposition testimony where a car comes rolling onto the screen like an old car in a junkyard, and then these spinning, flashy hubcaps come up on the screen with sparkles and, you know, referencing back to my opponent's opening statement that the car was a beautiful car and our music was just dirty hubcaps, and we had a little fun with that. And at the end of the day, the jury awarded us, I believe, over $4 million in punitive damages.
And at the end of the day, we received an award of 100% of Bad Boy's gross revenue with no deductions at all, which is the only case I'm aware of where an award of 100% of revenue was obtained with zero deductions.
To this day, that case and all of the stories involved make it one that I will, of course, never forget. So I hope you've enjoyed hearing the story of Westbound Records versus Bad Boy Records, and you've enjoyed this episode of Blurred Laws and Life. And don't forget to come back next week when the great Scott Schrier will be my guest. Have a good week.